The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, mapping every fatality in the Irish Civil War.
The conflict, when you adjust for population, Kerry was by far the most violent county, twice as violent statistically than Cork.
We'll hear about the Irish Civil War Fatalities Project from UCC, the first systematic attempt to investigate the number of people killed in the conflict.
Referring only to the Southern Civil War, the number we have is 1,420 odd.
And to begin this evening, we're visiting Marino to find out how high-quality housing was made a priority in the newly independent Ireland.
Even though we were broke, even though we were in a really terrible position, there was an effort made to do something about the situation. And there was a political will there.
100 years ago, construction began on the garden suburb of Marino in North Dublin, an early housing scheme in the Irish Free State, which today is a popular residential area with a distinctive appearance. We're going to hear about the history of Marino, an ambitious, idealistic initiative which Dublin Corporation intended to be a model of what good housing should be. But first, our producer, Logan Clancy, went to Marino to find out how residents are planning to mark this centenary.
It's not often that a neighbourhood can boast its own iconic theme song, but thanks to the familiar strains of the Marino Waltz, this community holds a special place in Dublin's collective memory.
John Sheehan grew up in Marino at the corner of St Declan Road and St Declan's Terrace. I met him a number of years ago. I spoke to John and he said he has very fond memories of growing up in Marino. And of course, he wrote the Marino Waltz in tribute to that. And I think we will be incorporating a Marino Waltz as part of our Marino 100 celebrations this year. It's a beautiful piece of music.
That's Mark Crowther, chair of the Marino Residents Association. We met at Carlton Hall, the community hall at the heart of the estate, where the residents gather to make their centenary plans.
It's a very unique place in that it is the first development in the Irish Free State after independence. I know the corporation have been working on other areas to building houses, but this one is recognised as the first one after independence, and it is uniquely associated with the history of the early years of the Irish Free State.
The name Marino dates back to the 18th century, when the first Earl of Charlemont named his residence Marino House, after the town in Italy. Lord Charlemont was also the one who built the famous Casino Marino. In the early 20th century, the area was identified as the ideal location for a new type of housing project with a modern architectural style and large communal green spaces.
You look around Marino now, certainly the first part of developed Marino, which was on the Marino House lands, all the houses are very distinctively very different. Then the corporation kind of ran out of money and simplified the development for the latter half of the estate. But it's still a unique estate with wonderful green spaces. We have two large circles. If you're not from Marino, it takes a long time to get used to how you find your way around the estate. I remember one time my wife telling me she was on the bus coming through Marino when there was still a conductor on it. And she heard the conductor saying to the driver, as they came around the second circle, there was a football match on, and the conductor said, "See, I told you there was two circles in Marino." The driver thought he'd been driving around the same one twice for years.
My name is Patricia Normandly. I'm involved with the Residents Association here. I'm secretary of the Marino Residents Association. People talk today about the concept of the 15-minute city as an urban planning concept. This is a good example of it, that people can walk, go to the local schools, walk to the shops, do all those things without having to jump into cars like a lot of urban areas where people live. We want, I suppose, to celebrate the centenary of Marino, the vision and ambition of Dublin Corporation at the time, who built the estate where we all have the privilege of living now. We want to also celebrate the present and the future of the estate. We had a number of community engagement sessions, workshops, where we invited all the residents to participate in sharing ideas about how it could be celebrated or what they thought was important. So we'll be launching the programme of events on the 18th of May here in the hall. One of the main events in the summer is a midsummer festival in one of our green areas for children, for adults, for everybody. And then a number of history talks throughout the winter.
The association is also developing a heritage trail, a booklet with various maps which will highlight the history, the buildings and the notable people who have lived in the area.
My name is Jerry Edgley. I'm the treasurer of the Merino Residents Association and the Merino and District Community Centre here. People would be interested to know from a historical significance that maybe three of the seven signatories of the 1916 proclamation actually lived around Merino. Tom and Kathleen Clark lived in Richmond Avenue. Thomas McDonough lived in Woodlands, which is just off Phillipsburg Avenue. And Eamon Kant lived in 23 Fairview Avenue itself. Now, apart from that, there were a lot of other people that people would recognise, whether it was James Joyce, Maureen Potter, Rosie Hackett, Kevin Heffernan, Cahill Brewer, and there are others. So we have the individuals, we have the buildings, and then we would have events as well. So each of the maps can be looked at independently and walked independently, or they can be combined. So these will be available via booklet to everybody in Merino and Fairview, and they will also be available online just to get onto merino.ie, and in the future they'll all be there as well. It just re-invites people to look at the past, look at where they're living, to be able to appreciate Merino for what it is, and to keep this history alive.
Celebrating our past is very important in terms of how we see ourselves today and how we see the future. Mainly for people going forward in the future to see the value of living in a place like this and as an example of how other communities could live.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there from Merino in Dublin, where residents are marking the centenary of this garden suburb this year. And you can find out more about their centenary plans at merino.ie. I'm joined now in studio by Dr. Ruth McManus from the School of History and Geography at Dublin City University, who has researched the history of this estate. You're very welcome back, Ruth, to the History Show. The concept of a garden city or garden suburb begins to become popular, what was it, kind of end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, there, thereabouts?
Exactly. In fact, the concept was originally devised by a man called Ebenezer Howard, an Englishman, who publishes a book in 1898, which wasn't even called anything about garden cities. It was called Tomorrow, A Peaceful Path to Real Reform.
Doesn't even sound like it's about buildings.
Exactly. But this idea that he had of taking people out into newly built cities, right out, self-sufficient garden cities where everything would be in one place, as a way of escaping from all of the problems of the 19th century city, the overcrowding, the pollution, so on and so forth. But his idea actually took on a life of its own very, very quickly. The first garden city was built in 1903 in Letchworth in England, and there was a subsequent one in 1919. But in the meantime, the people who designed that garden city ended up also designing suburban areas, the most celebrated of which was Hampstead at the edge of London. And their designs for this garden suburb were what really took hold. And that was the idea that came to Dublin then in the 1910s.
So a garden city has everything you need. A garden suburb is, as the name suggests, is adjacent to a larger city, a
exactly.
larger urban entity.
It's the difference between being self-contained and being a suburb.
Now, there was a desperate need, obviously, in Dublin for new housing, for quality housing, and that was revealed, you know, people were well aware of the fact, given some of the things that happened, the Church Street disaster, etc., etc. But there was a housing inquiry in 1914. What did that tell the city, the fathers and mothers, about Dublin housing?
Well, the inquiry showed just how desperate the state of housing was, the fact that 13,000 houses were urgently required. The corporation had managed in the previous 30 years to provide a tenth of that figure. There were a huge number of people living, about 20,000 families living in one family tenements. So huge overcrowding, which led to ill health. And that desperate overcrowding, that very poor conditions, but also ability to pay was very limited. So people were restricted in their accommodation and in what they could afford.
I would assume, though, the timing of the report was not great. 1914, there wasn't much opportunity to act upon the findings of the report.
Exactly. In fact, there had been a push really from about 1910 and this whole idea about garden suburbs. There was a huge interest in modern ideas about planning and about housing. The corporation was trying to do things. The report comes out and, of course, then we're into wartime conditions. No construction at all practically takes place. Then, and of course, that continues, persists really for nearly a decade. There was almost no housing. So there was a huge shortage of housing for all classes in society by the time we get to the Free State.
So basically, things are bad in 1914. They have got much worse by the 1920s.
Exactly. There's a huge deterioration.
Give us an idea then of how ambitious the Merino project was, the size of the houses that they were constructing, the facilities available to each of the householders. I mean, it was intended at least to represent a huge jump in standards,
yes,
wasn't it?
One of the interesting things about Merino is it had been thought about for a very long time. The very first mention of using Merino for housing goes back to 1910. This idea of what they called a miniature garden city. So, and they had actually got so far as to come up with a plan for Merino in 1919. And that couldn't be proceeded with owing to the political conditions, as they put it in the report. So they'd had a couple of runs at designing Merino. And when the final plan comes around, a lot of thought and consideration has gone into it. There's also been an overall new thinking about design and layout of housing coming from Britain really after the First World War. So there was a big report on how the reconstruction of Britain and of housing, which was called the Tudor Walters Report. And that had lots of ideas about housing density and about layout and about having lots more light and air. And all of those things were then adopted in Merino. So one of the things that came out of that new way of thinking was that the houses should be bigger. And that's one of the things we see. All of the houses in Merino had five rooms. Now, not five bedrooms, but five rooms. They all had indoor plumbing, hot and cold water. They all had a scullery. They all had gardens front and rear. It was low density, about 11 houses per acre. The previous schemes that the corporation had built could be 40 or 50 houses to the acre. So there's a lot more space. There's a lot more light. It's considered to be a healthy environment. And of course, that came at a price as well.
So the delay caused essentially by the War of Independence was not necessarily a bad thing. It allowed the planners to get their act together.
I suppose so. It could certainly be argued that way. It also perhaps allowed the costs to come down a little bit because wartime inflation had done terrible things to the cost of building houses.
Now, Merino was intended very much also as a model of good housing, as a template that others could learn from.
Exactly. A Dublin corporation was very insistent on this. And that's why there's a lot of different housing types at Merino, although they all have the same basic number of rooms. For example, the exterior appearance is very varied. There's lots of different building materials used. It doesn't feel like an estate of all the houses being the same. There's lots of variety. The layout, some of the houses are in pairs, they're threes, they're fives, they're eights.
Front and back gardens?
All front and back gardens. Also, there was space for allotments, big also public open spaces in the centre of the scheme. And of course, there was space allowed for shops, there was space for the church and the schools. That was all considered and included in the planning.
Now, we're talking about 1920s Ireland, when we didn't have a Red Rex. We hadn't two halfpennies to rub together, basically. So funding was an issue, wasn't it?
It was a huge issue. And this was where certain things had to be compromised upon. And the government was very clear on the amount of funding and the grant available, that a house could not cost more than £750 all in to build. So I think the first phase in Merino, the houses were £747 to build. So they just about brought them in under the limit. And the corporation was kind of cross about this because it really wanted to do certain things that it couldn't achieve at that money. And that led to certain pragmatic decisions. One of these was that the main frontages, the main roads at the edges of the scheme, weren't built directly by the corporation. So they wanted those houses, say, along the Malahide Road and along what becomes Griffith Avenue. They called it the 100-foot road at the beginning, and along Phillipsburg Avenue. They wanted those areas to be even nicer houses. All of the housing was of very good quality, but they wanted these to be a little bit better, to have a better look. And they couldn't do that within the budget. So instead, they reserved those areas and made them available to others to build upon. To a certain, so the minimum price of the houses on Malahide Road, say, would be £750, so that they would be in excess of what they could build themselves.
But these are privately built.
And they're privately built, and some of them are built by a builder's guild, and some of them are built by a public utility society, which is a kind of a housing co-op. And the good thing about that is that you got a little bit more of a social mix, you got a bit of variety in your housing type, and of course it was cost neutral to the corporation, so they continue that policy then thereafter. So it turned out to be a pragmatic decision that ended up being a good solution.
And all of this is in the context of something called the £1 million scheme. What was the £1 million scheme?
So when the Free State comes into existence, the government is really keen that something should be done about housing. It's a huge issue right across the country. A lot more attention had been placed on rural housing in the previous 50 years or so. But right across the country, there was a huge need for housing. And as a sort of a marker that they were going to do something, they had this great headline. It's like a great soundbite in today's money, I suppose, that they would give £1 million towards housing, which sounds very dramatic. And of course it was. But at the same time, given the cost of construction, it meant about 2,000 houses scattered across the country. Nevertheless, it was an important first step. And schemes like Fairbrothers Fields, which is now known as the Tenters, and Merino came under this scheme in terms of how they were funded and so on.
Things weren't helped by the fact that there was a strike in 1924. Tell me about that.
Yes, Larkin. Up to no good, I suppose one might say. And yeah, construction stops for, I think, 4 or 5 months, which was hugely disappointing to everybody involved in the scheme. Yeah, it was discussed in the Dáil as well as in the corporation as a huge source of frustration, really, because people felt that they should all be pulling together to make this thing happen.
Now, interestingly, land policy migrates. Rural land policy, tenant purchase in a sense, migrates from rural Ireland to urban Ireland, because these houses were not for rent. They were sold through a tenant purchase scheme.
Yeah. And again, talking about pragmatic approaches, the corporation was trying to deal with a huge problem, as we've already established. They had limited funds, and they also had the ratepayers always getting cross if they started spending too much in housing. They were never able to claw back an economic rent, which was to cover the costs of the housing. So it was always a burden on the rates if you built a new housing scheme. So it was, again, pretty much a pragmatic decision rather than a political one to say, well, we'll actually sell these houses to the tenants. So the houses at Merino, which we already saw cost about £750 to build, were sold over a period of time under tenant purchase scheme at between £400 and £440 per house. But that was felt to be a good idea from a financial point of view. And also then later on, they sort of said, well, that they kind of justified it by also saying, well, it made for good citizens because these people would take care of their houses. They had a vested interest in them now.
And also a lot of these people were moving out of rental schemes, which meant that, you know, rental houses or rental flats or whatever became available.
Yeah. So the Irish Times wrote a little bit scathingly that these houses were only for the aristocracy of the working classes because of the cost. But at the same time, because they vacated tenement houses, it meant that there was more housing there freed up. You know, you could argue whether or not that was really very effective, but that was the same argument that was being made across the board at the time.
And as we go through the 1920s then, is there constant tension, continuing tension between creating good housing and essentially tackling the scale of the overall housing problem, creating any kind of housing?
Yeah, Yeah, it's an ongoing issue. How can you balance the need to provide decent housing for the people with the sheer scale of the problem and the affordability question? And this sort of plays out in different ways in different schemes. So Merino is tenant purchase. Then we have Drumcondra is the next really big scheme from to 27, where they compromise again by making some of the houses smaller. So some of them only have three rooms in Drumcondra, for example, again for tenant purchase. And then by the late 20s, so by 1929, we see the government stepping in, the Department of Local Government doing a sort of a survey of what is the housing need across the country and saying, well, we're not actually tackling the problem of the slums here, and starting to propose that modified houses are built. So modified, you know, slightly less fancy houses, I suppose, the modified four-room house became prominent. And then we see a shift from building the tenant purchase houses going back to rental schemes. So in Cabra, we see that switch over point. Half of Cabra was built for tenant purchase and then they switched to rental.
Are we going, you know, the crisis that we're going through today, are we in a position to learn lessons from the Merino project?
I suppose I always say this, the biggest lesson, I think, is that even though we were broke, even though we were in a really terrible position, there was an effort made to do something about the situation. And there was a political will there, even with all of the problems and all of the compromises and all of the criticism that they were faced with, they did something.
Yeah. And now we're not broke.
Exactly.
That's another story for other programmes to discuss. We're the History Show. You have an online exhibition now on all of this called Housing the People, Building the State. Just tell us about that. What's involved with that?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to get some funding from the Royal Irish Academy Decade of Commemorations bursary. And housingthepeople.ie gives the context of all of these schemes and what the Free State was trying to do in those that first decade of its existence.
So housingthepeople.ie, if you want to have a look online at what we've just been discussing, that and other projects. We've previously looked on the show at the history of the Tenters, the history of Canester, and now the history of Merino, and all these early housing schemes give an important historical perspective on housing, housing crises, and the value of community as well. My guest is Dr. Ruth McManus of Dublin City University. Ruth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll be hearing about the groundbreaking new project which reveals the full scale of death during the Irish Civil War. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
The Irish Civil War officially began on the 28th of June 1922 when the National Army attacked the anti-treaty force occupying the Four Courts in Dublin. It officially ended on the 24th of May 1923 with Frank Aiken's dump arms order to IRA volunteers. So overall, an 11-month conflict. The Irish Civil War Fatalities Project is the first systematic attempt to investigate the number of people killed between those two dates. This is a University College Cork project in collaboration with RTE and supported with funding from the government's Decade of Centenaries programme. The findings are available online now. There's a series of articles at rte.ie/history with regional studies on the data uncovered. There's also an interactive map on the UCC website, which allows you to take a county by county look at who died, where they died and how they died. To talk about this, from our Cork studio, I'm joined by Dr. Andy Bielenberg of UCC, and with me here in Dublin is historian John Dorney of theirishstory.com. Over the past year and a half, they've been collecting all this information and using it to assess the geography and chronology of Civil War casualties and examine the social profile of the victims. John, you've been looking at this question of Civil War casualties for a lot longer than 18 months. I think it's a decade at this point. Perhaps now with this project, you're close to a final determination on the numbers. Could you start by breaking those numbers down for us? How many deaths were there? How many on each side of the conflict? And how many civilians were killed?
Sure, Miles. So the total figure we have for the official dates of the Civil War, so not including the before and after, and not including, you know, the first 6 months of 1922, which is very bloody in the north. But referring only to the Southern Civil War, the number we have is 1,420 odd, of whom the largest number are National Army or pro-treaty personnel, about 650 of them. There are about 440 anti-treaty deaths, mostly IRA, of course. And in the 26 counties, about 340 civilians, with about 30 or 40 more in the north.
And this is not, because we're talking about an 11-month period, it's not entirely out of line with, say, War of Independence casualties, is it?
No, it's not entirely out of line. There's some notable differences, though, Miles. So we have the Dead of the Irish Revolution Project, which has a figure for War of Independence deaths, and they are higher. So there's about 2,000, 1919 to 21, up to the truce. Now, they're more evenly spread over the 32 counties, is one thing. The other thing that's very different about the Civil War is that there are an awful lot more civilians killed in the War of Independence. So that might surprise some people, but there are about three times more civilians killed in the War of Independence than in the Civil War. One reason for that is the North is not necessarily violent during the Southern Civil War, where a disproportionate amount, about 80% of people killed north of the border, are civilians. But another reason, probably more important for our purposes, is that the combatant sides in the Civil War don't really target civilians systematically, whereas they do prior to the truce. Like the IRA, for example, kills about 200 people as informers. British reprisals often include killing civilians who they think, rightly or wrongly, are affiliated with the Republican movement. So that's one perhaps surprising thing about the Civil War, is that civilians are to a large extent left out or not targeted.
Hmm. Andy, let's talk about the civilian dead of the Civil War, perhaps one of the more overlooked aspects of the conflict in the past. Broadly speaking, did these civilians die mostly by accident? How did they die? Why did they die?
Well, what was interesting was that we found that about 40% were deliberately targeted, this 40% that we could discern. So quite a lot were deliberately targeted. But 27% were killed in crossfire and over 20% in accidents. So some might call that collateral killings.
So 40% were actually targeted. That seems like quite a high figure. Who was being targeted? Were they being targeted by the National Army? Were they being targeted by anti-treaty Republicans? And who were the victims?
They were targeted more by the National Army, people who didn't stop in roadblocks and stuff like that. In among Republicans, killings in raids, there were a few civilians who got killed that way. One of the big distinctions with the War of Independence was the number of spies killed. In the War of Independence, you're looking at about 191 spies have been documented as being killed, suspected spies, I should say. In the Civil War, it's far, far lower. We've got a number of about 13 or 14. And this is one of the factors which explains why civilian deaths are far lower.
But would people who were not necessarily identified as spies, but were identified as collaborators with the National Army, for example, were they being targeted by the Republicans?
To some extent, yes, there were cases like that of people who worked, civilians who worked for the National Army, in some cases were killed.
And what about the age range? Because I'm assuming that National Army, Republican forces, the age range would have been kind of late teens, early 20s to late 30s. But I presume that the age range of the civilians that were dying would have been much broader than that.
Well, the civilians would go right across the age spectrum, of course, and you would have some older people who were killed. You also have children who were playing in the streets, you know, killed in traffic accidents or shot accidentally, really. So yes, the spectrum is far wider in the case of civilians. But one of the interesting things is that there was a big gender difference between men and women among civilians killed. Of course, 5% of the fatalities overall in the Civil War were women, far lower, only 5%. But of course, most of those, the great bulk of those, were civilians. But one of the things we found was that younger women were more inclined to be targeted or were killed. Children, female children playing on the streets are just as likely as, as boys to be killed, whereas women who were married were more likely in the household. So there seems to be less women killed in the marriageable age range upwards.
So they weren't collateral damage. Their daughters were collateral damage, but the mothers were in the home. They weren't.
Exactly, exactly. So there's quite a gender difference in the age profile.
One of the things that intrigued me, John, was that there were four British Army fatalities in the Civil War. Now, people wouldn't have been aware of the fact that there was still a British Army presence in Dublin in particular, and in some of the garrison towns around the country during the Civil War. What do we know about the four members of the British Army who died in the Civil War and how they died?
Well, all four of them were in Dublin. Dublin is the only place by the outbreak of the Civil War where there's a British Army garrison. There's also some military presence in the treaty ports, but that's it. They've left the rest of the 26 counties, what will become the Free State. And of those four, one of them is killed in action. So British forces played a small role in the fighting in Dublin at the start of the Civil War. He's killed on Talbot Street. Actually, he's a member of the Royal Air Force. There's a number of other soldiers wounded. Like, they were involved in a small number of operations with pro-treaty forces, you know, which is obviously kept quiet because it's in no one's interest. They're also targeted by the anti-treaty IRA in Dublin when they can, for the opposite reason, because it's good for propaganda. But there's one assassinated. He's sought out and killed. Actually, he's shot, before the Civil War, but he dies afterwards in hospital, so he gets included in our figure. There's one who shoots himself by accident. And there's another one whose fate is unclear, so it's at first put down as an assassination, but then there's some suggestion he may have shot himself. It's not clear what happened to him, but that accounts for the four British soldiers killed.
One of your own areas of interest is the Civil War in Dublin. You've written a book on the subject. Dublin was the deadliest county in absolute terms during the conflict. Largest death toll, 260 violent deaths by your account. But if you dig down into those figures, it's rather more interesting. You've written that the figure somewhat overstates Dublin's role in the conflict.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. So first of all, Dublin has the most victims, but Dublin also has the largest population. So we'd expect that. But secondly, quite a few of the people in our figures were wounded elsewhere and they just died in Dublin in hospital. So that knocks up Dublin's figure a bit. And thirdly, one thing that we might get onto is the extraordinary number, really, of accidents, particularly among the National Army and the pro-treaty forces. And what you find is they happen around garrisons, and Dublin is the biggest garrison. So that again inflates Dublin's total a bit. It makes it look like it's the combat is fiercer for longer than it was. That said, I mean, there is a common perception, which I tried to tackle in my book on the Civil War in Dublin, Miles, that the Civil War in Dublin was over after the first week in the fighting in the forecourts in O'Connell Street. And that's not the case. There's a significant anti-treaty guerrilla campaign afterwards, and it's quite troublesome for the pro-treaty authorities up until the winter of 1922, when it starts to fall away. But the other thing to say about Dublin, though, is Dublin, along with Kerry and one or two other places, is quite vicious. So it becomes very personal. There are a lot of personal vendettas pursued in Dublin. A lot of the anti-treatyites who are killed there are either executed formally, or they're informally executed. They're murdered, as they put it. And this lends a special tinge to the Civil War in Dublin, as it does in Kerry, that the anti-treatyites perceive themselves as victims of a murder campaign. And that does play into subsequent, I think, Dublin Republican culture.
And executions in Mountjoy, for example, are they there? They would be included in the Dublin statistics?
Yep, executions as well, I should have mentioned. So Dublin has, if I remember correctly, 18 official executions, which is the highest number. So in Mountjoy, in Kilmainham, in Beggar's Bush Barracks, and in Kilbarracks, one or two as well. So that would be another thing adding to Dublin's large figure.
Mm. Andy, the way the data is presented, placing where people died on your interactive map, means inevitably that there are concentrations around Dublin and also around other urban centres. An exception, surprisingly, given its record in the War of Independence, being Cork. But just tell me about how it is skewed, how the concentration is skewed around urban centres.
Well, the old garrison infrastructure is very important here, because barracks, the old barracks, are in these larger urban centres, Limerick, Tralee, Cork. These are kind of major garrison centres in the conflict zone, if you like. And of course, those garrison centres, there's a lot of accidents in the barracks. They also, these places have the hospitals, where a lot of people are wounded and wind up in hospitals, and a lot of these are also in barracks and so on. So you get this concentration in these centres. Also, of course, even in the conventional phase, there's very heavy fighting in Limerick, Cork, Tralee. They're very contested urban centres. So there's a whole series of reasons. And in addition to prisons, we've got to remember that many of the victims died in prisons, particularly the Republican victims, as the war went on. So there are a whole series of reasons, and the executions and these deaths in custody, all these factors build up in these urban locales. And this accounts for concentrations, secondary concentrations in places like Dundalk, in Kildare, in Wexford and Waterford, Galway, Athlone and so forth.
Now, the story here, the fatality story, is not dissimilar to the War of Independence in the sense that a lot of casualties, a lot of fatalities in Dublin. Once you get outside of Dublin, the concentration is once again in Munster. When you look at Cork, when you look at Kerry, when you look at County Cork in particular, and the county, the entire county of Kerry, there's a key difference in the numbers of pro-treaty and anti-treaty combatants who die, though, isn't there?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. You'd imagine that Cork would be relatively anti-treaty in terms of death, but actually more people died on the pro-treaty side in Cork than in Kerry, where the opposite was the case. Far more Republicans died in Kerry. And Kerry, of course, was far more difficult to subdue. The IRA was more anti-treaty. There were more neutral IRA in Cork. And this is why the conflict, when you adjust for population, Kerry was by far the most violent county, twice as violent statistically than Cork. So this is a big difference in the campaign.
And the city of Cork itself, obviously, I mean, you talk about barracks and you talk about hospitals, and that would have impacted. But I'm assuming that the fact that the Republican forces did not really contest the city of Cork with the National Army means that the statistics, the fatalities for the city of Cork are not as high as you might have expected.
Yes, that's an interesting point, that the Republicans defended Dublin at very high cost. They defended Limerick and also Waterford. And so in the battles for all those cities, there's a lot of despoilation, artillery is used, a lot of people are shot. In Cork, while the Republicans certainly contested the landing at Passage in Rochestown and on the lead into Douglas, after they had lost that, they rapidly withdrew chaotically from the city, burning all the barracks. But to the great relief of the civilians, it meant the city was saved from the kind of despoilation witnessed in Limerick and Waterford and Dublin.
So all of this means when you adjust for population, Kerry is the most violent, or Kerry suffers the most fatalities of the Civil War. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's by far the most violent county. It's twice as violent as anywhere else. It's well ahead.
John, when it comes to the National Army, it's interesting that the majority of recruits have no previous military service, because there is I don't know if you'd call it a myth or if it's factual or not, that something like half of the National Army were British Army veterans, were Irish who had served in the First World War.
Yeah, so there's no doubt that there were a large number of British Army veterans, most of them Irish, but there are, interestingly, some British veterans we find in the casualties. Now, how many exactly there were, we can't determine by our casualty figures, because we have 600-odd National Army dead out of more than 55,000 were recruited. And, you know, the true total is higher because people are discharged in the Civil War, so well over 60,000 served. Now, that said, our figures show that among casualties, about 1 in 4, 25% had served in the IRA in pro-treaty forces. About 17% had served in the British Army. So considerably more, significantly more, had served in the IRA than had served in the British Army.
So if it was a case that 50% were British Army veterans, they were better at avoiding getting killed, basically.
Well, possibly. I mean, another possibility is, so the National Army's significantly expanded in January 1923 when the Civil War is still going on and the Free State still has a big crisis in terms of ongoing and open sore, if you like, that's bankrupting the state. But most of the combat fatalities on the pro-treaty side have already happened by that point. So that could play into it as well. But as you say, I mean, the thing to note about the National Army, and I think even allowing for the discrepancy between casualties and total figures, is the considerable majority, well over 60%, had not served in anything before. They're young men, they have no experience, they're unemployed, a lot of them. One of the interesting things we found among casualties is the socioeconomic background of the National Army soldier is significantly lower than on the anti-treaty IRA side. And this is because, just like the British Army before it, the National Army recruited among the labouring classes, if you like, of town and country. So most of them had no experience. And this probably also explains the very large number of accidents on the pro-treaty side. So around 1 in 3 of the casualties, something like that. An appalling amount is self-inflicted, either killed by friendly fire, killed occasionally in disputes with their friends, but often killed by weapons accidents or vehicle accidents. And this probably is largely because of their inexperience.
How do you come by all of this information? And is this easier now than it would have been, say, 50 years ago or whatever, to compile these statistics?
Absolutely. I mean, this would not have been possible even 20 years ago due to really the internet and the digitization of so many sources. So the key one is the military service pensions collection, which accounts for many of the deaths, not all, but many of the deaths, combined with the digitization of the death certificates. Now, we also went to the General Registry's office, which is in County Roscommon, to check the physical death registries. But those two were the bedrock sources, and they weren't available in the past. The military service pension, in particular, that collection has a wealth of detail on circumstances of death, location of death, address, social class, previous service, all of the metrics that we were able to use for this project. Really, the military service pension collection is the key source.
Andy, what about Northern Ireland? Because the War of Independence, it's generally ignored, but the fact is that in the War of Independence, like, the city of Belfast suffered almost as many deaths as in Cork, which would have had very, very high casualties, relatively speaking, in the War of Independence. How does Northern Ireland, how do the six counties fare during this 11-month period of the Civil War?
Well, Northern Ireland is very quiet in this period. Of all our deaths, Northern Ireland in toto accounts for 59 of the deaths we have. So it's the quietest part of the country, in effect. And although Northern Ireland had been, you know, in terms of civilian killings, there were a very significant number of civilians were killed before the Civil War, more civilians that weren't actually killed in the Civil War. In Belfast alone, civilian killings in Belfast subsided very quickly as the Civil War got going. And as the focus shifted southward, the North became quieter. So actually more people from the North were killed in the 26 counties who've origins in the North than were actually killed in the North itself. The centre of the conflict was in the 26 counties, and the conflict was about who had the right to govern the 26 counties. So the violence in the North was really different. It was about something else. It was largely civilians who were killed. And if you like, it was could be seen as another civil war, a different civil war.
And there were 10 bizarre British Army deaths among those 59. Tell me about those.
Yes, unfortunately for the British Army, there was a major boating accident, a ferry going across to Ballykinlar camp with 9 soldiers and the ferryman. It sunk in bad weather, and that accounts for all the British Army deaths in Northern Ireland.
Now, is this the end of the project, Andy, or do you think that once this data is released, once this project goes online, once members of the public start playing around with the maps, for example, that you're going to get more information?
It's a public engagement project, Miles, so we expect to get some feedback from the public, and I'm sure we'll probably find about some deaths that we haven't been able to pick up in all the sources we've looked at. We're open-minded on that front, and we'll add to the total if more are found. We need to focus also on the period before the Civil War and after. We had to restrict our time range because for financial reasons and for time reasons. We did the research for this within about 15 months. That was our limit. So that's why we decided to stick to those dates. And I think we only just about made it. So I think it was the right decision.
So you might be looking at the truce period and at the period then between the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty and the beginning of the Civil War and the aftermath of the Civil War, the post-dump arms period. You might look at those in the future.
That's a possibility, but I think Eunan O'Halpin is looking at the pre-Civil War period. He's already, he's looking at the Civil War as well and indeed the aftermath. So he's taking a longer view, if you like, than us, because he's looking at the entire revolution.
The dead of the Irish Revolution.
Exactly. Yeah, we are looking at the Civil Wars much more specific.
Well, congratulations to both of you for putting this terrific project together. The data reveals some fascinating insights on the Irish Civil War dead and how the conflict played out in different parts of the country. The Irish Civil War Fatalities Project is, as I said, a UCC initiative in partnership with RTE. It's supported with funding from the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media as part of the Decade of Centenaries programme. And you can find regional studies of the data at RTE.ie/history, where you'll also find a link to that searchable interactive map of every conflict-related death during the Civil War. My thanks to Andy Bielenberg and John Dorney for joining us this evening. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.